Welcome to the Florida Roundup. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Thanks for being with us. Tom Hudson is out this week. Well, following a messy election, new leaders will soon take control of Florida. Governor-elect Ron DeSantis is just days away from being sworn in. Now, although he still has a few key roles to fill, DeSantis and his team are working hard now to fill hundreds of jobs in his new administration, and he's already announced appointments for some of the state's most prominent posts. Meanwhile, state lawmakers are filing bills, getting ready for the 2019 legislative session that kicks off in March. And they're likely to take on a number of issues, everything from voting laws in Florida, water quality, the environment, and education, looking at possible new security measures in schools in the wake of the Parkland school shooting. Also, expect school choice and voucher programs to be on the agenda. And then there's the matter of the state budget, which is facing a lot of pressure after the impact of Hurricane Michael. There is so much to talk about as we look ahead to the year in politics and what we can expect in Florida in 2019. We're pleased to welcome to discuss some of the biggest stories to watch for this year, A.G. Gankarski, writer for Florida Politics. Good morning, or good to be with you.
Good afternoon. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. And Adam Smith, he's political editor for the Tampa Bay Times. Hey, Adam.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us, guys. And as we talk about the year ahead in Florida, we want your calls from anywhere in the state. Give us a call at 305-995-1800. Join the Florida Roundup by phone or tweet us at Florida Roundup, and we'll get your tweets on throughout the hour as well. And we begin with a look at what we can expect from the new Ron DeSantis administration. Adam, let's start with you. Governor-elect Ron DeSantis will be the youngest governor elected to this position in decades. And, you know, similar to former Governor Rick Scott, he comes into the position with little experience in state politics, former congressman, former military guy. How do you believe age and experience will play into DeSantis's ability to demonstrate leadership in his first weeks in office? What can we expect?
Well, it is interesting that we have the youngest cabinet I think we've probably ever seen in Florida. I'm not sure it's really going to make that much of a difference. Bob Graham was just slightly older than DeSantis when he came into office. But again, we do have somebody that has no executive experience, really. He was a sort of a Freedom Caucus congressman, which is usually not somebody that is ready or eager to compromise on anything. So his executive priorities are a little unclear. Also, he didn't, unlike Scott, who he clearly came in talking about jobs, DeSantis didn't really lay out a very specific agenda.
Yes, we're waiting to see what his agenda is, AG. His inauguration is coming up Tuesday. What are you going to be listening for in his inauguration speech?
I want to hear a rhetorical appeal, like his outreach to people, especially Democrats, independents who didn't vote for him. That was a razor-thin election result. We saw 8 years of Rick Scott, and Rick Scott didn't make a lot of deals with Democrats. DeSantis seems inclined to. I mean, he has a good relationship with Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried. She's coming in. She's a Democrat. Also, Jared Moskovitz, part of his administration. So DeSantis seems to be looking to reach across the aisle. And I watched inauguration speeches over the weekend. You know, what jumped out at me was the rolling appeals that Bob Graham made, talking to the entire state. I think DeSantis would be well served to make these kind of appeals, sort of unify Florida, bring it together. Because after, you know, the 8 years of Rick Scott, I think a message of healing has to be the way forward.
And it's 305-995-1800. What are you hoping for from the new Ron DeSantis administration? What do you think are the biggest issues the new governor, the legislature need to take up? Give us a call. Okay, and then Adam, let's talk a little bit about our new Lieutenant Governor, Jeanette Nunez. She becomes the first Latino woman to be elected to that office, the highest ranking Latina member of government in the state's history. How significant do you see her role as being? And she also comes with experience in the state legislature as well. How does that play in?
Well, that's going to be a question that really Ron DeSantis will have to answer, because, you know, the lieutenant governor is essentially a do-nothing job. So it's really the call of the governor to decide how active she will be. That said, the expectation is she will be active. She's a self-described policy nerd. She's well-respected and has great relationships in the legislature. So she should be a big help if utilized with Ron DeSantis, who's still not well-known among most of the Tallahassee folks. So she could be a significant factor.
Yeah, I would think that would matter a lot, considering that DeSantis' entire political career has been in Washington up till now.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's a big part of it. In Washington and the Fox News green room, as the Democrats used to say. But Jeanette Nunez, she brings a lot to the table, including that 8 years of legislative experience. She chaired the Health and Wellness Task Force or Transition Committee. So you can see her taking a lead on these positions. What the future of healthcare looks like in Florida, as, you know, the Affordable Care Act is in doubt, you know, as our own, like, hospital models are in doubt. You know, that's really the thing to watch. I think Nunez can play point on that.
And let's talk about healthcare for a minute. Of course, Florida is one of the states that declined to expand Medicaid with the passage of the Affordable Care Act. The Democrats have retaken control in Congress, in the House, and they will certainly work to shore up the Affordable Care Act any way they can. Let's talk about healthcare in Florida. There are still between 800,000 to 1 million people that fall into that donut hole of coverage, Adam. They can't afford to buy insurance, but they're not poor enough to qualify for Medicaid. The legislature will be dealing with so many issues when they convene in March. How do you see them addressing health care?
I wish I had a good, clear answer for you. I don't know, but you can say that the political climate is almost 180 degrees different from when they were initially debating whether to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. A lot of these provisions are very, very popular now, and Florida has stepped up in a big way to join for people to get covered under the Affordable Care Act as is. And Ron DeSantis spent a good deal of the campaign suggesting that no, despite having voted to repeal Obamacare over and over and over again, he wants to keep some of those key provisions like protecting pre-existing conditions. So it's an issue that Republicans opposed to the Affordable Care Act are very much on the defensive again about now, whereas they previously were very much on the offensive.
Yeah, the voters have moved, and so the politicians have moved. AG.
Yeah, but there's still the funding piece to, you know, to consider on this, because, you know, Florida's budget, it's going to be a tight budget game this year. We've got hurricane issues we're going to discuss a little bit later. You know, Rob Bradley, the incoming Senate Appropriations Chair, is a big reserve hawk. So I don't know if there's going to be the appetite in the legislature to really expand what there is now. I think the best you can hope for is a little bit of status quo and emphasis on pre-existing conditions.
And if you're just tuning in, it's our first Florida roundup of the new year. We're live across the state talking about the biggest issues this week here in the Sunshine State, and we want your calls. It's 305-995-1800. Give us a call here on the roundup. Let us know what issues are most important to you as 2019 kicks off, and tweet us at Florida Roundup. Okay, let me ask you both about environmental issues. Politicians from both parties, of course, took campaign money from the state's powerful sugar industry. That changed over the last election cycle. Big Sugar took a lot of heat over the state's algae crisis. Now both Governor-elect DeSantis and Agriculture Commissioner-elect Nikki Fried have stood in opposition to the sugar industry. Adam Smith, is Big Sugar's influence in Florida on the wane?
Yeah, I think this is, we've talked about this a lot, but I think it's an underestimated story in terms of significance. Sugar has been maybe the single biggest and most influential player in Florida politics for so long, whether it was with Bob Graham or Lawton Chiles or Jeb Bush or a lot, you know, Debbie Wasserman Schultz. A lot of Democrats and Republicans alike have largely done what Big Sugar wanted. This is the first time that we have a governor who's really been pretty overtly hostile to the sugar industry, and whether that's a true commitment or whether that's responding to, you know, so many of his constituents and voters facing, you know, algae blooms and whatnot, and we'll see. But that is a giant different direction in terms of the approach toward the sugar industry.
Not only that, the new DeSantis administration, the legislature, they'll continue to grapple with the issue of Everglades restoration, what to do about pollution in Lake Okeechobee, efforts to mitigate climate change, increasing pressure on leaders from both parties to get serious about that in Florida. You see a lot of leadership at the city level. Mayors in Orlando and Miami and Tampa, for example, putting together coalitions to try to address this. We haven't seen any statewide leadership on this. Will we see that this year? AG.
That really remains to be seen. I mean, DeSantis has called himself a Teddy Roosevelt Republican on environmental issues. The sugar stance that DeSantis took in the primary was in part because Adam Putnam had sugar money and the sugar industry was targeting DeSantis with negative ads. And that drove a lot of this. But he is branded as an environmentalist. I think he's going to have to actually mention climate change. He can't do like what Rick Scott said and say, I'm not a scientist, so I don't know. I think DeSantis is going to have to play it a little bit more legitimately.
And what issues are most important to you, Florida, as 2019 begins? Maybe Amendment 4, which is now the law, implementing voter rights restoration for felons. That actually goes into effect next week. We've got calls on that issue. Mike is in Brandon. He's on the line. Hey, Mike, you're on the Florida Roundup. Go ahead.
Hey, thank you very much for having me. Yeah, I was, I'm curious how that's going to be implemented, because with the 2020 election, we won't have the governor nor the senator jobs up for election, but of course it's a presidential, and my understanding is there could conceivably be close to a million new voters. What are your thoughts on this, and how is it going to go down?
That's right. Mike, thanks so much for the call. You know, Adam, he's absolutely right. We had this razor-thin margin in the last election, electoral blunders, a recount, a nearly two-week-long recount, and we're going to be looking at up to 1.2 million new voters in this state before 2020 with the passage of Amendment 4. Those that have been convicted of a felony in Florida will be eligible to vote. And let's also mention the fact that according to the census, Florida is among the fastest growing states in America. That's going to affect redistricting and our voter pool as well. So, you know, as we wait for Amendment 4 to take effect across the state starting on January 8th, a political earthquake in your estimation, is Amendment 4, does it qualify as that?
I don't think it really does. I think every cycle there's talk of some political earthquake that's going to favor the Democrats, whether it's people from Puerto Rico moving to the mainland, it'll become instant voters, and the suggestion that there's going to be hundreds of thousands of new Democratic voters, that didn't really happen. And likewise, I think it's dubious at best that a million new, they may be a million new voters, but these are not necessarily at all likely voters. These are going to be a lot of people that probably don't frequently vote that are going to take a lot of effort to bring out to the polls. That said, it does seem like there's going to be a fight, maybe a legal fight, over just how difficult the legislature makes implementation of this the will of the people on this.
And another big headline from the week was the report that came out looking into the mass shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. One of the recommendations in that report was a proposal to arm teachers. Tom has some thoughts about that in Cocoa Beach right now. Hey, Tom, thanks for your call.
Yeah.
Hey, go ahead.
As a former middle school teacher and then later a professor in public education, I spent a lot of time in schools. I also spent 2 years in the military and the infantry. And this proposal to arm teachers, as I understand, their weapons will be carried with them at all times and concealed. This is just a terrible idea. It's getting off on the cheap so they can pay the teachers a couple extra bucks to protect in case some crazy comes in with an AR-15. It's so ridiculous, it's almost funny. I don't know what Florida's going to do about this, but the proposal right now is ridiculous.
Tom, thanks for that call. And we need to note the PTA, the Teachers Union in Florida, they've come out foursquare against this idea. A.G. Gankarski is sure to be litigated if districts try to go forward with this proposal.
Yeah.
But at the same time, this report said not every school district in Florida, in their view, is doing enough to increase school security.
Right, but you know that raises several questions, including one of unfunded mandates. You know, we've seen school systems already having to implement, you know, stopgap solutions for school safety. And you know what would happen if they required this and there was no legal protection for the districts? Like, let's say a teacher, you know, uses a gun in a classroom. This is risk. This is exposure, and this would be irresponsible for the districts, in my view.
Adam Smith, it's really remarkable that this is still being proposed. It was actually a minor line in this overall report, which took a really wide-ranging view at a lot of other issues around school security, like getting more mental health counseling to vulnerable and troubled students, for example, more prevention measures. You know, you aren't hearing many teachers say that they're in favor of this.
I don't hear a whole lot of parents that are eager have this done, too. I do hear some, I think this is going to be, the last session was the first time in forever that the legislature actually enacted gun control measures. And I think a large part of that is because Rick Scott was not in a primary. He was already campaigning for the general election, campaigning for the center. So he was able to get behind something like that. This year we don't have an election looming, so that could make something that could be very helpful to the NRA and those that support this.
You know, and let's keep in mind too, schools are doing what they can to meet the new mandates for security. In Duval County, for example, here in Jacksonville, there's a lawsuit against armed safety assistants in Duval County Public Schools. These aren't sworn police officers, but different districts are trying different ways, different methods of meeting the state mandate to essentially harden the target AG of the school campus.
Yeah, and you know, the districts in the state, they have such different needs. I mean, Miami-Dade is different from Duval, is different from Orange County, and different from the rural districts for sure. There's a lot of the state where people have gun racks in the back of their trucks as they go to school. So this is something where a one-size-fits-all solution may not be viable here. You know, the state also has to create a funding formula so that school districts in urban areas that bear the greatest risk have resources so they aren't imposing them on locals.
It's 305-995-1800 to join the Florida Roundup. We also want your tweets at Florida Roundup as we talk about the biggest issues facing Florida in 2019 with Adam Smith, political editor for the Tampa Bay Times, and A.G. Gankarski, correspondent for Florida Politics. Adam, before we go to break in a moment or so, schools in terms of school choice and school funding and school vouchers also expected to be near the top of the agenda in Tallahassee in March. What are you looking out for?
I'm sorry.
I think we've lost Adam Smith.
No, I just got cut off. I'm sorry. I got to make you repeat the question. My bad.
Really quickly, just 1 minute till the break. School choice and school vouchers. Go ahead.
We've got Richard Corcoran, the former Florida House Speaker, and maybe the most ardent supporter of school choice and accountability measures and alternatives to traditional public schools since Jeb Bush. So I think this is going to be a major issue. He's no shrinking violet, and he will be pushing the envelope big time.
We'll watch that. But meanwhile, much more to talk about after the break. The environment, medical marijuana, and hemp. Voting reform, elections reform in Florida, that's a big issue too. Lots more to come here on the Florida Roundup, along with your calls and tweets. Give us a call right now. Get on the line at 305-995-1800. It's the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Back in a moment. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. I'm Melissa Ross, and as we continue talking about the biggest issues to watch for in 2019 here in Florida with Adam Smith of the Tampa Bay Times and A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics, calls coming in from all over the state. Lots of callers concerned about this idea of arming teachers that's been proposed. Kay is in Ponte Vedra. Hi, Kay. You're on the air. Happy Friday. Go ahead.
Happy Friday and Happy New Year to you also. My comment was in support of the gentleman who previously called in, who said he'd not only been in the Army, but had he said he's been a police officer, that's incidental. I was talking to the uniformed professional officer that's assigned on a contractual basis, I believe, through the school district to be at my granddaughter's school during the school hours, and he too felt that it was absolutely the most inappropriate method to arm the teachers or to train and arm the teachers. So I think the majority of people on both sides of the fence feel that that's the most inappropriate way to accomplish this. What are you hearing? Similar kind of support?
Thank you, Kay. That's Kay in Ponte Vedra and A.G. Gankarski with teachers and parents groups, Foursquare against this. It's hard to see how this actually comes to pass. Now, the report did say only teachers that volunteer for this duty and go through extensive training would do it. But still, is this a non-starter?
This feels really hard to get through, legislature, media, a lot of people paying attention. There just doesn't seem to be a lot of organic support for this concept. And it's a hard sell, volunteer or not, especially given the attrition rate with teachers. We lose teachers within the first 5 years very often. So every time you lose a teacher, you have to retrain them on this stuff. You know, that creates costs and there are other unforeseen consequences.
It's 305-995-1800. Join us right now statewide on the Florida Roundup. Greg is in Venice, Florida. Hey, Greg, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Great, thanks. Go ahead.
I've listened to a lot of discussion and shows on this. And I've never heard of anybody coming up with a basic, an officer with a canine dog patrolling the area, the hallways. A dog is a deterrent in itself. And I'm sure that if they use them in the service end, the drug end, finding people, they surely could use them to detect ammunition or a gun or the oil of a gun. And such. Has anybody talked about that?
Canine units in schools. Adam Smith.
I cannot say that I've heard that. I don't know what I really don't know what the logistical obstacles would be to hunting for firearms. I mean, certainly you seem to see that at least with explosives, but I don't have a good answer to that.
Okay, Miami. Let's go to Miami. Jennifer is in Miami right now. Hi, Jennifer. What are your thoughts?
My concern is, since arming teachers or arming the schools is a state mandate, if the situation arises that a child is killed by a teacher's bullet, who will assume liability? Is it the state or the school district?
Right. Jennifer, thanks. I think that's one of many issues that is probably going to lead to this not really coming to fruition. The liability issues alone, A.G. Gankarski, are pretty mind-boggling to think about.
You would see a number of co-defendants in any case like that, including the local school district, the board members, the legislature, and so on. It would be a very nasty, high-profile case. Again, it just sounds like a policy with unintended consequences.
Calls all over the state on this. Adam Smith?
I just chime in that I am not one that thinks that this is necessarily a non-starter. There may not be a lot of organic support from parents or teachers, but organic support is not something that's driven the Florida legislature for a long, long time.
That's a good point.
you have some influential sheriffs that are for this. They look at the videos of what happened in Parkland. The guy had an opportunity to reload. There are reasonable arguments that could have made a difference, nor is this a legislature that is especially keen on doing whatever the traditional education establishment prefers.
Yeah, that argument, though, I mean, it basically boils down to a trained officer is abdicating his duty. Therefore, a teacher with some volunteer training should fill the gap. That's irresponsible, I think. And another issue I'd bring up is to the caller who talked about a cop with a gun, with a dog going through a school. One issue with that is that many of these school districts can't pay the cops to come without dogs. We're getting to the unfunded mandate territory again, and this is the classic situation in Florida. The state government wants things. They don't provide the funding formula.
And as you pointed out, Adam, the legislature also has a way of going its own way and not necessarily listening to the voice of the people. Lots of voices, meanwhile, joining our show. Robert is in Tampa right now. Hey, Robert, what are your thoughts?
Hi, ma'am. Good afternoon.
Hey.
I was in high school in 2001 9/11. My high school went into lockdown. The teacher who was instructing us that day took out a Beretta 92 and put it on her hip. So these things actually already exist. People in, you know, classes, teachers in classrooms actually do carry. I am in the service industry. I'm in the maintenance industry. I do go to a lot of schools, and I can tell you that it does exist.
Yeah, so I'm sure some teachers do.
Is decriminalize it.
I'm sure some teachers do. And yeah, and I think the question too is, are we going to expand this so that more of them are carrying a concealed weapon? Let's take a few more calls on this, and then we'll move on. Jordan is in Pompano Beach. Hey, Jordan, thanks for your call.
Hi.
Hi.
Yes, so I am not a gun person at all. I would not consider myself one, but I'm actually in favor of allowing teachers to concealed carry as long as, you know, they have all of their proper permits and they've gone through thorough training. I think they should do it twice a year, every semester, and they should not be compensated monetarily. It should be strictly voluntary. You know, only those who are willing to do it should be allowed to do it, not compensated for it.
All right. Thanks, Jordan. Thanks for that call. Lots of callers here Friday on the Florida Roundup as we talk about all the issues expected to rise to the top of the agenda in Tallahassee with a new governor, a new legislature, and a whole new agenda for the new year. We're talking about everything from school safety to school choice and the environment. Let's also talk a little bit about medical marijuana. There was this horrible rollout after the amendment legalizing medical marijuana passed a couple of years ago, Adam Smith. But more and more Floridians want medical marijuana, and they're using it. It's likely to keep growing. Nikki Fried, the new agriculture commissioner, ran on this issue of expanding access to cannabis. One of the few Democrats to ascend to this height in the Florida cabinet. How much leeway will Nikki Fried have to push forward medical marijuana policy and expand access to this drug? How do you see that issue playing out this year in the state?
I think she's on the right side of public opinion, and it seems to be that the governor-elect Ron DeSantis sees it that way too. He seems to be signaling he's going to stop fighting a lot of the efforts to curb medical marijuana. It's worth noting there was a recent report, maybe it was this week, last week, that came out looking at the revenue that marijuana has brought in states like California and Colorado, and at least I'm somebody who was surprised. It was a tiny, tiny amount. So for those that think this is going to be a great help to fund services in Florida, it appears that it will not be.
A.G. Gankarski, industrial hemp. Is that going to be Florida's next big crop?
I think Florida's going to play in the space. I mean, will it be Florida's next big crop? There's a lot of competition, such as Kentucky, places like that. So I think Florida's going to play in that space. I think they're going to expand the cannabis industry here. You know, I did want to point out regarding the small revenue legalization states like California and Colorado, part of that is because they're still phasing out the illegal market. The black market exists, and it's a competition for the illicit market. And I think one of the things about Florida's model for medical cannabis is the vertical integration, the lobbying of the companies, the political connections, and what that's going to do basically writ large is create political capital both here and outside the state.
And Adam Smith, didn't a decision this week just come down from a judge where the dispensary Trulieve took legal action to make its business easier to access for customers?
Yeah, I didn't read the opinion, but I think the state is losing more and more of the momentum in the legal fights.
And lots of calls here on the Florida Roundup. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about the big issues we expect to take center stage in 2019 across the state. It's 305-995-1800 to join us as we speak with Adam Smith of the Tampa Bay Times, A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics, and we want your tweets as well, at Florida Roundup. Lots of calls on a lot of issues. Rosa is in Fort Lauderdale. Hey, Rosa. Thanks for holding.
Hi.
Hey, go ahead.
Happy New Year.
You too.
Thank you. My biggest concern for this year and the next several years is access to reproductive rights in Florida. Given the new governor and that we now have two anti-choice Republican senators, we really have to rally for reproductive rights. A lot of people don't know this, but without access to reproductive health, you know, the right to abortion and to birth control doesn't matter. And we now have, thanks to Rick Scott, as of last year, a network of fake women's health centers getting state funds statewide. There's about 200 of these fake health centers that basically all they do is they offer services to verify a pregnancy and what they call limited ultrasounds. And they don't offer anything else. They don't offer pap smears. They don't offer wellness care. They don't offer birth control. They don't offer fibroid or endometriosis treatment. All they are is these, you know, religious and ideological outfits that are masquerading as health clinics to try to lure women away from comprehensive health care, like Planned Parenthood or like other independent providers that provide the gamut of reproductive health care for women. So I am extremely concerned given what's happening nationwide with the Supreme Court, given what's happening now also with the health department, the U.S. Health Department that's created a faith-based department within the health department. And we're talking about a department that deals with the CDC and with the USDA. So I'm extremely concerned about access to reproductive health for women in Florida and in the whole country.
Rosa, thanks for that call. That's Rosa in Fort Lauderdale. And you're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Okay, let's talk about that. You know, Brett Kavanaugh is on the Supreme Court, certainly a justice that pro-life conservatives pushed hard for. At the same time, we are looking at a possibility that within the next year or so, a challenge to Roe v. Wade will make its way to the highest court. We are looking at a scenario across the country where some states could overturn access to legal abortion, including this one. And I'm curious to get both of your thoughts on that and also how that will affect voter turnout, perhaps in the 2020 election. Will that affect turnout, say, from pro-choice advocates in the state, women who don't want to see legal abortion overturned in the Sunshine State? Let's start with you, AG.
Well, I mean, every election cycle, that's the question, isn't it? There's been this assault on reproductive rights for years in the state. There's been the chipping away at it, and the activists say every election is the most important election. And, you know, I think you're going to see, you know, the same dynamics in play here. I mean, Ron DeSantis isn't going to push anti-abortion legislation, but he's not going to veto it. As a Republican with political ambitions, he's going to, you know, do the Republican thing. So if we see these bills come through and they get through both chambers, they will become law.
Adam Smith, you know, when Gwen Graham was running for governor, she did not win the Democratic nomination for governor. But that was a big part of her campaign push, saying elect a Democrat or abortion will be illegal in Florida in 12 to 18 months. Was that hyperbole, or is that something that you see as potentially having political legs, political possibility?
It was probably hyperbole, but it's not entirely off base that if the Supreme Court, with Donald Trump's Supreme Court picks, leaves it up to the states, which is no longer an unlikely or far-fetched scenario, the legislature will be in a position to decide whether abortion is accessible or not in Florida. And if the makeup of this legislature and the governor's office, there's little question that they would do as much as possible to restrict it.
Let's take one more call before we take a quick break. It's Cindy in Tampa. Hi, Cindy. How are you?
Hi. Happy New Year.
You too. Go ahead. You're on the Florida Roundup.
Yeah, I just wanted to speak to the Amendment 4 going into effect immediately. You know, one of the speakers said that he doesn't think it'll make a significant difference. Like we've had previous things that were supposed to increase a Democrat's advantage, like Puerto Ricans and so forth, and he doesn't think it will be significant. First of all, I'd like to say it may not be huge, but it doesn't have to be huge, given the razor-thin margins by which the Republicans are winning across the state. So I do want to make sure that it isn't somehow stymied by DeSantis, who has said something like he thinks a bill with implementing language that should be sent to him for his signature. It sounds like he's dragging his feet, and I'm not sure why, but it seems like they're still trying to deny the will of the people, which the legislature has been known to do when they have something go through that they don't agree with.
That's Cindy in Tampa. Thanks, Cindy. Yes, the governor-elect DeSantis did say that the issue needed to be studied. Those who pushed for the passage of Amendment 4 said, no, it's self-executing. People should be able to show up on January 8th and immediately be eligible to register to vote, AG. We'll find out more on the 8th if some of those who try to exercise their new franchise face any difficulties.
Yeah, I mean, you know, somebody who has their rights restored is there on January 8th, by all means, they should go to the SOE because, you know, that amendment is self-actualizing.
Yeah. Adam Smith, was that just political rhetoric from DeSantis, or will there be more foot dragging on Amendment 4?
Well, the caller made an excellent point that it doesn't take much to tilt an election in a state that keeps deciding elections by less than 1%. But yeah, it does seem like foot dragging, but it's also worth noting that some of the election supervisors have had some questions about, you know, how do they check these records? Has somebody really completed their sentence? Have they paid all their restitution, et cetera? And it's not an absolutely simple answer.
Well, thank you both so much, gentlemen, for your insights as we spoke with Adam Smith of the Tampa Bay Times and A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics. Thanks for being on the show. And in a moment, why sex offenders are, the numbers of them in Florida are spiking. You're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for being with us this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. My co-host Tom Hudson is out this week. Well, a new state report says that the number of sexual offenders and predators living in Florida has risen by more than 50% in the last 13 years. Legislative auditors report that nearly 29,000 registered sex offenders and predators now live in this state. That's an increase of 53% since 2005. Orange County, home to Orlando, actually has the highest total number of sex offenders and predators in the Sunshine State, with nearly 2,300 listed. What's going on here? WMFE reporter Danielle Pryor joins us from their studios in Orlando with more about these numbers. Danielle, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me today.
And it's 305-995-1800 to join the Florida Roundup. Okay, Danielle, you looked at the state audit. What are some of the major takeaways when you go through this data about sex offenders in Florida?
Well, absolutely. Like you said, there is a 53% increase that we see since 2005 in the number of sex offenders and predators living in the state. The majority are in Orange County. The good news is that that's only about 60% of the total that's only about 40% of the total registry. The rest of the 60% of the people on that registry are actually not living in state anymore, or they've been committed or deported. So it's kind of a bit of a mixed bag there.
Okay, so I guess then these shocking, frightening headlines are a little misleading, maybe. It's not quite the number that we thought.
Well, I mean, definitely the increase is something I think to be concerned about. But the good news is, like I said, is it's just a small portion of that overall registry.
Okay, how does the state track sex offenders? What's the process?
The Florida Department of Law Enforcement keeps an online registry of offenders and predators. And the way that it works is when you're released from prison or put on probation, you kind of go to your local sheriff's department and enter into this registry. And that way, local enforcement officers can kind of have all this information that they can kind of track you with it and, you know, keep track of your whereabouts using. They know where you live and will, you know, eventually kind of check in and do checkups kind of on you to make sure that you are living where you say you're living and that you're following state statute that says if you've committed a crime against a child under the age of 16, that you're not living within 1,000 feet of, you know, a school, a park, places where a child would be. And then on top of that, if you are under probation, there's just some more scheduled routine checkups that go on. They can search houses for things like pornography and alcohol, and in some cases, you know, the evidence of minors in the houses. In extreme cases, there's even electronic monitoring that goes on.
Right. And so the state is doing a pretty good job of tracking people, but we don't really know yet why Florida is seeing so many more sex offenders choosing to reside here. Does the study go into any of that?
Not really. Orange County is one of the places, actually, where there are some of the most offenders and predators throughout the state. And one of those theories is that the housing restrictions, the residency restrictions, are not as strict as they are in other places throughout the state. In some places, again, if you've committed a crime against a child under the age of 16, you can't even live within 2,500 feet of places like zoos and libraries and even public benches in some cases. So the fact that Orange County makes it a little bit easier for people to find housing might be why they are kind of coming to this area.
Yeah. So Orange County, Orlando, the highest percentage of sex offenders in the state, as this news is breaking in Central Florida, parents checking, you can go, I guess, onto the FDLE registry and check and see if you have a sex offender in your neighborhood. That's easy to find out.
Yeah, they have a fantastic website as well as an app that you can use. You can kind of look up by zip code, or, you know, even if you know the person's name. And, with the zip code, it's really great. It pulls up a map and it shows you all the offenders, predators, kind of the whereabouts, roughly of where they live, even folks that are transient, homeless, their whereabouts. And if there's enclaves as well of offenders and predators in your area. And you can find information, you know, very specific information, photos of these people, what their crime was, when it was committed, even the tags on their license plates. And then law enforcement can use the website to even find more specific information, identifying factors that might help them track online activities that they might be partaking in.
And we're talking right now with WMFE reporter Daniel Pryor about a new study showing that Florida has a big increase in the number of registered sex offenders living in the state, more than 50% in the last decade or so. So as we've been learning from you, Danielle, the state tracks sex offenders closely. There are lots of restrictions that sex offenders face. It can be very difficult once you're on this registry to find housing, to find a job. Tell us a little bit more about the restrictions and the barriers set forth in the law and how this affects people's ability to, because people have to live somewhere. So it can be a very difficult situation.
Absolutely. And for counties like Miami-Dade, where, you know, they have some of the highest numbers of homeless sex offenders and predators, we can see the effect that, when you can't find affordable housing and you can't find people that will allow you to rent, you know, you have no other choice but to kind of live, on the streets or in these homeless camps in the woods and that sort of thing. But if you are on this registry, it means that you can't apply for HUD subsidized housing. You can't apply for subsidized housing under the Fair Housing Act, the Federal Fair Housing Act. And in many cases, again, if you've committed a crime against a child, you can't live within 1,000 feet of anywhere where, you know, children might congregate. So it makes it very hard to find housing unless you are looking into enclaves of housing units that are specifically built and maintained for folks that are on this registry, which in some cases is done by faith-based and for-profit organizations throughout the state. And then when it comes to finding a job, again, if you've committed a crime against a child, same places where you couldn't live and find housing, you can't work. So that means, you know, you can't work in schools, you can't work at a park, you can't work in a library. And so there's been studies that show making it so difficult for people to find housing and so difficult to find jobs not only leads to the high number of transient people on this registry, which is about 6% of the registry, but it also kind of heightens the chance that they're going to go back and recommit kind of the same crime that got them on the registry in the first place.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Okay, so you just mentioned about 6% of the people on the sex offender list in Florida are transient.
Right.
Homeless, essentially, without housing. Has this, now that these numbers are out, is the state going to take a serious look at addressing this? Because as you said, this is a list that Florida doesn't want to be on. And we're also getting tweets asking whether there's any distinction between sex offenders.
Absolutely.
Are there distinctions between being someone who's perhaps engaged in public lewdness, say, as opposed to someone who has raped a child?
Absolutely. There is. And based kind of on those offenses, you know, that'll determine whether or not you are living in the community in Florida, whether you are living in the community in Florida but under probation, or whether you are committed to an institution. And I should make a point as well that being a sex offender versus a sexual predator, a predator is someone who's done something sexually violent. So that automatically is a little bit more extreme there. But yes, when we're talking about sexual offenses, we're not talking about public indecency. We're not talking about disorderly conduct in public. We're talking about serious offenses, child pornography, things that we would normally think of as more serious sexual offenses. But to your point about homelessness, I think that the state will obviously need to look into some of the underlying causes of homelessness, which is, the lack of affordable and accessible housing. But it's not just for sexual offenders and predators. That's for people throughout, right? In urban areas, I know in Miami-Dade and in Orange County, we all have this problem with finding affordable housing. And like I said, there are some faith-based and not-for-profits that have kind of entered this realm of offering housing for these folks, but more will need to be done for sure.
Right. And we need to be clear, too. The highest total number is in Orange County, but South Florida has a big population as well. And Duval County, Jacksonville also has a large population.
Yes. So Orange County has just the highest population of sexual offenders and predators, whereas Miami-Dade has the highest number of homeless sexual offenders and predators.
Okay. Anything else that strikes you in this state audit? Any other findings or takeaways people need to be aware of as we get wrap our head around these numbers?
Absolutely. I think it's interesting to look at just how expensive treatment is, and the fact that, when you are in a probation program, a lot of times treatment is required in order for you to successfully complete probation and not to end back up in, the criminal justice system. And for a lot of folks, the fact that they have to pay for their own treatment, is a real struggle for them. The evaluation, the primary evaluation for treatment, can be upwards of $100 in some cases. So I think there's a real kind of social justice aspect to that fact that, there are treatment is very expensive, and there are 10 counties that don't even offer, state approved treatment programs.
Sure. So we're looking at numbers now. I guess the next step is what to do about those numbers. We'll have to wait on that, won't we?
Right.
Danielle Pryor, a reporter from WMFE in Orlando, joining us from their studios with more about the new report showing a big spike in the percentage of sexual offenders and predators living in Florida, up by more than 50% over the last decade. You can check on FDLE's website to see what's going on in your neighborhood, but much more to follow with this story. So Danielle Pryor on the line from WMFE in Orlando, we so appreciate you taking a few minutes after going through this complex report to be with us. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much.
And that is our show. The Florida Roundup is produced by WJCT Public Broadcasting in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Bridget O'Brien and Heather Schatz are producers. Jason Zabka is the WLRN Director of Radio Programming and our Technical Director. WLRN's Director of Radio Operations is Peter Mertz. Our theme music by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. I'm Melissa Ross. Tom Hudson and I will be back next week. Thanks for calling and listening. Have a good weekend.
On the next Evening Jazz. It's an organ trio party. The trio belongs to Pat Bianchi, and they're hosting a bunch of special guests, including Joe Locke, Pat Martino, and the late Kevin Mahogany. Pat Bianchi in the spotlight on the next Evening Jazz. That's tonight. Showtime is 9:30.
When you have almost...